You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today we're happy to have with us Amy Bloom, author of the novel Lucky Us, which was published by Random House just last month. Amy is the author of Come to Me, a National Book Award finalist, A Blind Man Can See How Much I Love You, nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award, Love Invents Us, Normal, Away, which was a New York Times bestseller, and Where the God of Love Hangs Out. Her stories have appeared in the Best American Short Stories, O. Henry Prize Short Stories, the Scribner Anthology of Contemporary Short Fiction, and many other anthologies. She's written for numbers of magazines, including The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Atlantic, and teaches creative writing at Wesleyan University. Thanks, Amy, for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
So, I own an independent bookstore, and I always say this, that you know, people tell you you can't judge a book by its cover, but everybody does judge a book by its cover. And you have such a great cover, and it's by someone, Deborah Van Alten, whose work I've always admired. As you said in one of your interviews, it's kind of like a copy or a mixture of the Dutch Masters and Freud's Middle Period. So tell us a little bit about why you chose this and how you feel it relates to the book, and if you've ever used her work before.
I haven't ever used her work before, and I sort of stumbled across her book. She's an artist in the Northeast, and I was just very struck by her work, and there's always a sort of slightly surreal quality, but she also works in a certain kind of hyper-realism, which I happen to like.
Me too.
And this particular picture struck me as being just right, because I thought to myself, you know, lucky lion not to fall off the tightrope, lucky zebra not to be eaten by the lion, and lucky little bird to get to go along for the ride and see what happens.
Well, it really works, and as I said, it's one of those books whose cover, and also even the texture of the cover, that feel to it, it's one of those books you just can't pass by, which really gives you a leg up because people pick it up, as I did when it first came in, and take a look at it. So whoever, did you get to, you got to choose the cover yourself without them?
I did get to choose the cover, and they gave me a lot of input into it, which I really appreciated. The mystery of the texture of the cover, I don't understand. It's like a suede finish.
Yeah.
I don't know how they did it, but it feels like fabric, not like paper. And whoever came up with that bright idea, I'm very, very grateful.
No, I was just running my hand over as you spoke. So, you know, sensorially, I think it's a great cover. But be that as it may, why don't you tell us a little bit about the story and about two very fascinating and very different sisters, Eva and Iris?
Well, I think, you know, for me, there are, the center of the book is really three people. It's certainly Iris and Eva very, very much. And the third person who comes in sort of an important way partway through the novel is Gus. And Gus is really our portal to the war itself, since the book takes place between 1939 and 1949. And Iris and Eva are two half-sisters who don't meet until they are 12 and 17. And I love the idea, for me, of both exploring the relationship between sisters, but also how one chooses one's family. You know, plenty of people have sisters that they speak to once a year, and it's true that that's your sister, and it's true that you might be the perfect candidate to give her a kidney, but that doesn't really speak to the quality of the relationship. And I am interested in how people choose their people. And these two girls, you know, connect with each other and, you know, have some real difficulties. I also wasn't terribly interested in, oh, the sisters who are rivals, who's the pretty one, who gets the guy? And those stories are just not terribly interesting to me. And I was much more interested in their development as people and then the family that they create around themselves, as well as their adventures, you know, from Ohio to old Hollywood to sort of the post-Gatsby mansions of Long Island.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you said that about them being rivals. There's only one moment in the book, I think, when I think Clara may say to Eva, oh, your father says you're the smart one. And Eva says, oh, not the pretty one. And that's the only point that I really saw that type of feeling. It's interesting you mentioned Gus, too, because Gus's life, his adult life, is kind of bookended by the sisters in different ways, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, and as a writer, you know, creating a story in which they frame his life and he frames theirs was interesting. And it's one of the things that made using letters as part of the narrative so appealing to me.
It was funny because I got off on the wrong foot, kind of, no pun intended, with Gus, because that line he says where he says he has ears like Gable and nose like Durante.
Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, well, why would she? And then I realized that wasn't what it was about at all, was it?
Well,
and
no,
his leg, too.
Yeah, but and I have to say, in my personal experience, if you have to choose between men who are a little self-deprecating about their appearance and men who tell you how good-looking they are, I prefer the guys who are a little self-deprecating.
Yeah, I understand that completely. But then the
as
other...
As my mother used to say, surely that's for other people to say.
I do that, too.
Yeah.
but the other side of the coin is Clara, whose life revolves at... And I can't even imagine her protocol of getting ready for her night at the club, but Clara's totally concerned with her looks for a couple of reasons.
Because her looks are so complex, and her role between black and white America is so complicated, and so she is extremely mindful of appearance, which also gives her a lot of insight into appearance. I mean, as she says at one point, she understands that race is mostly a matter of appearance, but not only a matter of appearance.
Yeah, it's funny that one of the ways I can tell whether a book is really good if I can remember the characters' names without writing them down, and I did that. Not that I agree with the way she wrote what she wrote about, but Ayn Rand, I can still remember from when I was 15 years old the names of the characters and Atlas Shrugged and things like that. So it always
absolutely
is, yeah, like Dominique Francon and you know, Peter Fallon and all that, Howard Roark, Henry Reardon. But you've done kind of the same thing, and you've created this, as you said, they make their own family, like Eva does with the Torellis and Francisco. So maybe you can, in trying to shape the book a little bit for our listeners, because I always personalize it, tell me a little bit about those families, like the Torellis, and what a nice guy Francisco was.
Francisco is a wonderful guy. Francisco is the uncle or grandpa or dad that you would love to have. And one of the things that makes him so great is that he is not just passively kind, which many nice people are, but he's actively kind. In other words, he's not just sympathetic when Iris and Eva fall on hard times. He does something about it. He invites them to dinner. He helps them find work. He tells them the truth about how bad their situation is. And that, to me, is a really admirable quality. Plus, the other thing about Francisco that really stands out, I think, is that he is utterly at home with who he is. You know?
Yeah.
He is a fat, gay, middle-aged Mexican makeup artist. And he is okay with every single piece of that. And that's one of the things that makes him so charming. And, you know, I think to some extent, I mean, just in a very small way, I had a high school teacher who was not a physically great-looking guy, you know, middle-aged, very overweight, not in great health. And one of the most appealing, lovely, irresistible, much-loved people I have ever known in my life. And because he knew who he was, and he was comfortable with it. And it made it possible to relate to him always in a way that was like very warm and very authentic. So Francisco is one of those characters for me. He is one of those people who does not have to reinvent himself ever.
Yeah, you meet in your life of very few people, and you, with regard to your psychotherapy, your psychotherapist past, you meet very few people in your life who are totally integrated, that don't resonate, their head doesn't ring like a bell, they just are who they are, they don't change their personality for other people. And you can count them usually on the fingers of one hand because you can immediately recognize them. And I think those kinds of people are so important and so valuable, and it's so hard and at the same time so easy to be that way.
Yeah, so he's to me is always kind of a light in the book, even when he's giving them bad news. And I feel that you would want somebody like that in your life. The Torellis, you know, are sort of recently made it to the upper middle class. This has been a working class family. Mr. Torelli inherits essentially, you know, a peddler's cart of fruit and vegetables from his father and turns it into a chain of very successful supermarkets. And they move up and they move to a very grand house, although they are themselves not very grand people. And I wanted to write about, you know, people who are very new to wealth and not always sure how to behave. But not from the point of view of, oh, ha ha, isn't that funny? People don't know how to behave. Because frankly, any of us who are put in new situations don't really know how to behave. But also the things that Eva and Iris find admirable about them. You know, these are decent, hardworking people who have done really well financially. And that doesn't really tell you much about who they are. And they are decent, hardworking people. And I really wanted to write about them from Eva's point of view, that this is the family she wishes she had.
Right.
It would have been wonderful to be a Torelli.
And the thing is, it's almost like they move so quickly up into these upper echelons, especially Mrs. Torelli, because Mr. Torelli is only, will only say stuff like, my mother died when I was eight, good luck. But but they, it's almost as if they don't know how to use the kindness that's inherent in them, like Mrs. Torelli. Like not going to this the funeral, but you know, they send the ham and all the fruit baskets. It's almost like they don't know exactly what to do. But then you see how competent she is with her son when he has his problems, and she takes him into the shower, and it's just she knows what to do, she knows how to be kind, but she's uncomfortable within that envelope that they've created for themselves.
Yeah, which makes sense to me. I mean, you know, really they are a small, tightly knit family who gets plunked down in a very affluent community where they have nothing in common with anybody. And so they sort of, you know, circle the wagons and live their lives. And I guess I wanted to write about people like that without necessarily taking a stance towards them. My preference is always, you know, let the reader experience the characters. I don't have to poke you in one direction or another. Let the readers enter this world and they will think what they like. And I'm sure there are people who are like, I love the Torellis. They're so great. Or like, oh, the Torellis, they weren't as nice as they should have been. But whatever the reader's experience is fine with me. My wish is that they get to experience the story without my being in the way.
Yeah, that's why your novels are such great novels for book clubs. And it's funny, too, because you're right. I hadn't thought about it. But you're not judgmental at all, because I was much more judgmental of Iris than you were.
That's probably true.
Yeah, I'm saying, well, what right does she have to even, almost even write the letters? And because Iris did some things that are, in my opinion, reprehensible, right?
Iris does terrible things, there's no doubt about it.
So it's a novel of forgiveness, and I guess forgiveness leads, my father used to say, you make your own luck. And
Yes. And I think you do make your own luck, and I think you also choose whether or not to forgive people. And there's some great, you know, Buddhist saying that, you know, hating somebody and thinking that will do you some good is like drinking poison and thinking it'll kill the other person.
Yes, I just heard that.
And so, you know, for me, it's not so much about forgiveness, because it's actually more complicated than that, because there are things that Iris has done that Eva doesn't know about. So she's not actually even in a position to forgive, which is also something I wanted to write about. You know, we never know everything about the people we love.
No, you don't. You never do. And that's how I felt about Gus. But then it's so funny because you throw curveballs at me all the time. Like all of a sudden there's Dr. Keith and Dr. Snyder, and I'm going, wait a minute, what's that supposed to mean? And then the other one is Dorothy. But where the heck does where the heck did Dorothy come from? Where did you dig her out of?
Well, I wanted an opportunity to write more about the friendship between Ruthie and Danny, about these two little kids, you know, an African-American girl and a white boy in this affluent suburb that neither of them belongs in. And Dorothy Berman just occurred to me, and it was just a great opportunity to get to see how the friendship worked between the two of them, because she is such an important figure in Danny's life, and I wanted an opportunity to sort of write about the world as the two of them were experiencing it. There's something about their friendship as little kids which was very appealing to me.
Okay, but seriously, like, whether you're typing on your computer or your pencil is above your page, and all of a sudden you say, I'm going to have Dorothy come out of the closet now, literally. Where the heck does that come from?
Well,
I mean, I think
the kids do a lot of weird things and play a lot of strange games that grown-ups don't actually witness or know very much about. But certainly in my own childhood, kids did weird things. You know, I had a girlfriend up the road when I was about 8 or 9 who would say things like, oh, let's play funeral. And the whole game was that you would lie down on the bed and the other person would march around the bed and maybe like go out to the garden and steal some flowers or go into the kitchen and like put a circle of cookies around you and then give the fake eulogy for the life that we, you know, you pretended you would have. So, you know, I could have done that story too. I think that kids are often fairly imaginative and fairly peculiar in their games. It's just that they are not, it's not what you do on a playground.
I have a good one. My little brother is like 9 years younger than me, and we used to have this thing called a living Sunday. So I would lay him on the floor, and then I would put a scoop of ice cream in his mouth, and then put chocolate fudge from, like, you know, Hershey's chocolate fudge, and drip that in there, then put whipped cream on top of that and some nuts and then a cherry. So luckily I didn't kill him, but there are a lot of things like that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think kids are peculiar. A friend of mine used to tell me about how he and his brother had a game called catering in which they would pretend that they were caterers, catering a fancy party, and they would run around like crazy and they would set up tables. And I think that people are peculiar, and I think that children often express that privately rather than publicly.
Yeah, and I think that kind of behavior, rather than coloring in between the lines, I think it leads to a more developed personality in life, actually. But so, you know, your books, everyone always talks about your first lines and how it kind of hooks the reader. And your first line in this book does exactly the same thing. And it's, my father's wife died. My mother said we should drive down to his place and see what might be in it for us. And how do you come up with those? And why do you think they resonate so much with people?
Well, I'm always glad that people feel that it resonates with them. I mean, I hear them in my head, and maybe part of what resonates is that it's not just like writing for me. It's speech. It's the address to the reader in some sense. And, you know, and you hope that you engage the person. You know, part of it is that the first things that I wrote were short stories. And in short stories, you don't really have a lot of room to mess around. You know, if you haven't grabbed somebody by the first paragraph of a short story, that's pretty much, that's that. And I love that about the rigors and the demands of a short story, and I think I tend to apply that to my novels as well.
Well, it's funny because some of the reviews talk about your novels in the sense of being auditory rather than visual. And I think that's true to a certain extent. And it's funny the way you... Do you have an image in your mind of what Iris looked like and what Eva looked like?
Yeah, I have some general images of them. I mean, I could fill it in, you know, I have a pretty good sense of what they look like physically, and of Gus and Francisco and Clara and Edgar. And certainly to the extent that if you drew them or brought in an actress, I would be able to say yes or no.
Got it. Well, that was nice what you did with Francisco, because even though you were talking about his physical attributes in not a negative way, but, well, almost like a negative way, but it's nice at the end in a certain spot where you talk about him almost as if he's, well, you do, you use the word handsome, with his silver hair coming down over his shoulders in the back, but you say the word handsome, which is interesting.
Yeah, I think, you know, the longer you live, it seems to me, the more your character affects your appearance. And, you know, beauty is one of those things that, you know, that goes a long way, but it's not just the external. And I don't mean, oh, if you have a beautiful soul, then it doesn't matter if you look horrible. 'Cause I think the truth is, if you have a beautiful soul, you're probably not going to look horrible.
It's funny, they have these studies about people who smile all their life. And how they're fit, and I saw like a page of each, people who smile all their life and people who don't, and you can see the difference. They don't need to.
It's
amazing. It's funny how you when you talked about Gus being pivotal as a balance between the two sisters, it's funny too because there are other people that are seem to serve the same purpose, like Danny and like Edgar.
Well, these people are all entwined, you know.
They are.
And so, I mean, that's part of the frame about it, which is that this is an extended family, you know, so that, in fact, there is a relationship between Edgar and Francisco that is quite separate from the girls, you know. But for Clara, Francisco is a very marginal figure because, you know, their periods in the lives of the girls don't necessarily overlap significantly in terms of relationships. There's Francisco's sisters who are so important to Eva, but not very important to Iris. And that's how it is in families. You know, you have a favorite cousin, you have an uncle. You know, you only see this person once a year, but you really care for them. Or you see them all the time and you wish you didn't. And so all of these people, you know, these are not random characters for anybody. They're all... their lives are all knit together, however loosely.
How did you come up with the third chapter, Dirty Butter, in which there's this kind of bacchanalian party, you know, akin to a Great Gatsby party, if not worse? How did you come up with that? And it leads to a dismal situation for Iris, but how did you come up with that?
Well, I have an excellent imagination, and I knew that these kinds of private, glamorous Hollywood sex parties, what women used to call the sewing circles, existed. And I thought, what must that have looked like? Because, you know, there are plenty of descriptions of sort of very fancy Hollywood private parties. People often had the parties at their big houses rather than out in clubs, for the same reason that people prefer not to go out in clubs now. Because even though they didn't have everybody with their cell phone and snapping pictures, you know, they certainly had plenty of reporters. So if you really wanted to have an amazing, private, exciting, once-in-a-lifetime kind of party, you tended to do it at your house. And I thought, what must that have been like?
It was really well done. You know what I like?
Thank you.
You know what I liked best about that chapter? When you discussed the unfortunate-looking woman there, and then she's approached by this other woman, and I guess it was Rose who said, "A lid for every pot."
Well, that is certainly what my grandmother used to say to me. That there was a lid for every pot. You know, people had to look, you know, long enough. And I do. I mean, it was just a lot of fun. You know, the big party gave me, again, sort of like Dorothy Berman did with Danny and Ruthie, it gave me an opportunity to reveal more about Iris, really, as a very young woman who is really quite naive and quite new to the world, but is also, you know, wants to be who she is and everything that is going on around her. And I did think to myself, oh my gosh, how amazing it would have been to be standing in that party. And so, you know, I wrote it as if I was standing in the corner making notes.
Don't you feel like I wished I had been in that party, too?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, who doesn't?
Really?
You know? I can't think of anybody who doesn't want to be at that party.
You know, what's funny is sometimes I feel like I'm not doing the author service because I read the book closely enough that I'm really interested in finding out things about it. But then I realize if people are listening to this, they've got to be interested in the book, right? I mean...
I hope so.
And then, you know, you do it with other people, too, like Mrs. Gruber, who really shares a very small portion of the book, but she's such a well-developed character that you do feel as if you know her, and you know her her peccadilloes and what she drinks. Is it creme de menthe?
Creme de menthe, yeah.
Yeah, my father used to serve that.
I know, it's disgusting.
It is. That and Galliano, which I really despise.
Yeah, also disgusting.
Yeah. Well, it's like drinking Vicks Formula 44.
Yeah.
Which my father used to do for his cough, but it also had 44% alcohol in it, so who knows. Mrs. Gruber, and she's a really nice lady, too.
Well, she's an interesting person, you know, because she's not just nice. She has some fairly harsh things to say and a fairly harsh view of the world. But I guess for me, no, I don't have minor characters.
True.
I mean, their whole... We might only see them for a little while, but they are... whole people. It's just like when you're walking down the street, those are all people. Now, they may be minor players in your story, but you know that in their own lives, they are the stars.
Well, the thing is, you make them knowable right away, which is interesting. Like the girls in the beauty parlor. What's the name of the salon?
La Belladonna.
La Belladonna. So, you know, when they set up Eva and her fortune-telling business, you know, when one says it's a dollar and the other one says, maybe we should make it 50 cents. And she goes, so now she has to make change, too. And so you know those two people then. And it's just through one line. Before you wrote this, did you know about tarot and tarot cards, or did you research that before you
wrote? I did do some research, partially because I sort of needed a refresher course. When I was a teenager, I worked as a shill for a psychic and tarot card reader.
Oh, cool.
In the Village in New York. And my job was to stand on the sidewalk on Friday and Saturday nights and say to people, Madam Rosa, $5. She knows all. And so I did get an excellent introduction to the art and requirement of being a fake psychic.
That sounds to me a little bit like Iris and how she won all the competitions for speeches and stuff. it's funny, too. You know what I wondered? Why? Why did you do your author's note at the end? Was it absolutely necessary? Did you have a reason to do that? It's a novel. I know it's...
You and I both know that it's a novel. But because I refer to so many events and... because I am so faithful to the history of so many of the events, but there are places where I take liberties and I move things around, and I just wanted to remind people that it was a work of fiction and that in the end the writer is really God, and the writer can move things and places and borders and boundaries as one wishes. But I also wanted to sort of be clear that because I refer to certain really significant historical events in America, including things like the internment of 11,000 Germans in the country, I guess I just had a wish to say lots of these things are true, you know, and I have moved smaller things when I have needed to. For example, I have to tell the truth. I believe that the song "Did You See Jackie Robinson Hit That Ball" actually came out a year later than I have it coming out in the novel. But those are the kinds of things I moved, not the internment of 11,000 Germans, not the Allies bombing Dresden, things like that.
It was funny, the only anachronism I picked up, and I figured, well, did she know this or did she do it for a reason, was when you said something like, she was like Jackie Kennedy would have been. But then I'm thinking, wait a minute, it's 1939 to 1949. So am I dealing where am I dealing from? Where, what is the perspective temporally of
this? Right, but the perspective right there is Eva much later in her life.
Like when she's looking back at the...
Right. And because the story is actually told from Eva's point of view, in Eva's narrative, I what I strongly wish to indicate is that this is Eva now.
But that's like... That's only like one context clue in the whole book, I would think, unless I missed a whole bunch of them.
No. I mean, there are actually several points in which Eva says, and if you talk to my sister now, she would say.
Right. Yeah.
So I wanted to suggest, you know, that Eva continues into the future, but I didn't want to write about her life in the 50s and 60s.
Got it. You know, it's interesting. So that author's note was like one of the Lewis Carroll's portmanteau words, like fog and smoke, you know, fog and smoke being smog. It's because you did say, hey, I can do whatever I want, and I did, but you were also saying, not that you apologize, but, you know, that they should recognize that you did take liberties. But it does serve, in my mind, two purposes. When I read it, I read it, and then I went back and said, wait a minute, what's this? And I read it a second time, and I kind of got what you were talking about.
Well, I do understand. It's also, I cannot tell you how many people do read books that are set in a different time period and are extremely attentive to things like what time, you know, the Wabash cannonball used to come into the train station in 1927. So this was also, I think, in some ways, sort of my my response and my interest in those people who are extremely attentive to historical detail.
You know, speaking of historical detail then, what about the, talk a little bit about Edgar and Eva and the Little Blue Books.
Oh, I love the Little Blue Books. They were just a wonderful thing to discover. They were a wonderful expression of a certain strand in the culture, which was for self-education. You know, lots of people in the 20s and 30s and 40s did not graduate from high school, certainly did not go to college. You know, the modern trend of sending people to college, whether or not they have any intellectual interest whatsoever, it didn't happen. People didn't have those options. And the Little Blue Books cost a nickel and eventually a dime, and they were manufactured to fit essentially in a man's back pocket or jacket pocket so that he could read it on a break, on a cigarette break, on a coffee break, at his lunch, wherever he might find himself sitting and having a little time to himself. And they were designed for the self-educated person, male or female, and they covered every subject in the world. And the idea was that if you read those books, you would know everything an educated person needs to know. So they were things like Proverbs of Ancient Egypt, the short stories of O. Henry, the short stories of Balzac, What Every Married Woman Needs to Know, which was written, by the way, by Margaret Sanger, History of Western Civilization, How to Make Candy. And there were thousands of titles that you could subscribe to and receive, and many people had a subscription, and so they would get one of these once a week or once a month, depending on your personal finances. And they are wonderful little objects. You know, they are not particularly well made. They weren't made to last. They are what librarians call ephemera, you know, objects that do not last, and they are just wonderful to behold because of the optimism and intelligence and the belief that intelligent people would wish to educate themselves whether or not they had the opportunity and the means for higher education.
Sometimes I feel like I want to be locked in my bookstore for 6 months and have them put a little tray underneath my door and have nothing to do but read everything there. And
absolutely.
And now they have these, you probably have seen them, the Oxford University Press has this A Brief Introduction to. They're $11.95, and I know I'm not going to sell, well, actually we do sell a lot of them, and I have the two revolving displays, and I have every single one, and they're numbered from one to whatever, and it's just like you were saying, you know, it could be brief introduction to quantum physics, socialism, or fascism, or the Bible, or Sartre, or Marx. And there's just so many of them that I tell kids or grown-ups, you know, if you sat here and read all of these books, you will know everything. You may not know about the Kardashians or Britney Spears, but you will know everything of value. And so if I know some kid who's going to be taking quantum mechanics that year in college, I give him that book and I say, pretty much, this is going to be your class. And if you read this book, you'll do well. And it's a wonderful thing to have. Absolutely wonderful.
And it was a great idea. And there is a fundamental optimism to that kind of endeavor, which is the belief that people would like to know that, in fact, information matters to people, not just, for example, what they believe or what they wish to believe or what they hope is true, but actual information, things that you can learn.
And
that strikes me as an optimistic stance about human beings.
And also one that's very relevant to our times, where information has essentially become the currency of our very existence. It's just information going back and forth around the world. And like I was saying at the beginning before we started about how this interview will go around the world. In the old days, it would go to be heard by 10,000 people or 40,000 people. Now it's available to 6 billion. It's absolutely amazing.
Yes, one wishes that the quality of the information would expand as exponentially as the size of the audience.
Unfortunately, it hasn't and won't. One interesting thing, and speaking of information and moving along in the world because of it, talk a little bit about Francisco and Eva's little plot scheme to get her into medical school.
Well, I don't...
It is.
Plot seems a little strong. I mean, they use what they have, and what they have is their intelligence and a couple of lucky connections, and I think that they look at an impenetrable world from which there is no recovering, and I realize if it was a different kind of book, you know, Eva would go to night school, and she would take organic chemistry and do well, and then when she's 45, she would get to go to med school, not, of course, that she would be admitted, since she would be a 45-year-old woman, you know, many years later, and actually not likely to get admitted to medical school. So they see the world as it is, not as it should be, and they do what needs to be done. A quality I admire in people.
Yeah, it's difficult. I think I was watching one of Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee series on Crackle, and he was interviewing, I think, Sarah Silverman. And she said, when someone says to her, I think I'm going to, as soon as she hears the words, I think I'm going to, she knows they will never do it. Like, I think I'm going to learn to water ski. I think I'm going to learn to ride horses. And it's very true. And Eva and Francisco and a bunch of people in the books, and Iris at the beginning, they just decide they're going to do something. They don't tell anybody they're going to do it. They don't say, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we did this? They just do it.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, it's that quality of agency in people's lives. And it is, it's the quality in which the fantasizing about it is just not that gratifying. You know, for some people, imagining that they will do something and also imagining who they will be when they are doing it is very gratifying. But for most of my characters, they are learning who they are, or they are making themselves who they are, and they want to keep moving forward, even when it's really painful.
It's kind of like, in a way, not to, like, praising you too much, but like in your book, like Lucky Us, and in all your previous works, and in your career, have these all been like things you pulled yourself up by your own bootstraps with? Are there influences that have said, okay, time to write another book, or you just wake up one morning?
I don't believe there's anybody out there saying time to write another book, except, you know, possibly my publisher. People can certainly encourage you. I mean, in my case, I didn't actually have any mentors or writer friends or anything like that. But you know, to get encouragement is not to have the problem solved. You know, in the end, to a large extent, you are on your own. And you make choices. I'm going to spend my time doing this. I'm going to spend my time doing that. I'm going to invest in this aspect of my life. You make choices. I'm going to spend my money on Botox, or I'm going to spend my money on a great meal, or I'm going to spend my money on comfortable shoes so that I can, you know, walk through the hills of Spain. I mean, whatever it is. I mean, if you're lucky enough to be in those kinds of positions. But people make decisions about their energy and their time and their gifts all the time.
Hey, well, since we've been going on for 44 minutes, I think that's an excellent way to end the interview. Because I could keep going on and on and ask silly questions, but I really appreciate you being indulgent of me and those questions and for coming on the show. And
well, I'm delighted. They were great questions, and it's nice to have an opportunity to talk about the book in this way.
Okay, great. Well, hopefully, maybe when it comes around on the paperback tour, we could talk briefly again, and hopefully, maybe if you're ever in the Philadelphia area, you can come and do a book signing at the store. That would be great.
I'd be delighted.
Okay, cool. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Mm-hmm. Right. Bye-bye.
Speaking with Amy Bloom, Lucky Us, her novel, which was published just last month, and she's got a whole bunch of really good books. Like I, when I introduced her, I told you all of them. And the cover really is amazing. When you come by the bookstore, take a look at the cover and see if you can walk by it without picking it up, or as we talked about, just its tactile sense of rubbing your hand across the cover itself. So next week is a great one. It'll be James McBride, who won the National Book Award of 2013. Last one, because it hasn't come out yet this year, which is The Good Lord Bird. And it was in hardback, just recently released in paperback, I guess, last month. It's a great story about three abolitionists, John Brown, Harriet Tubman, and Frederick Douglass. But it's a novel, rollicking comedy. And as I said it, to some people, actually, I had dinner with him the other night. And what it is the comedy allows you to step back and see what the history really was, because it disarms you. And then when you realize, hey, what am I laughing at? This is serious business. Then you can step back and reflect and re-reflect on what you've read. Anyway, it's a great novel. His memoir before that, The Color of Water, is one of the best books I've ever read and one of the most fascinating stories of a childhood. And then, you know, when I was talking to him, people were coming up to him saying, you know, this book changed my life. So I would highly recommend both books, but The Color of Water is really fascinating and a great book. So thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader. We're lucky now to have, I guess, must have done 140 interviews. We've interviewed three of the past four Pulitzer Prize winners, a bunch of the people who have won the National Book Award, the Man Booker Award. And Joel, it's just, like I've always said, it's just been a pleasure to be able to talk to them. And hopefully from time to time, I've asked questions that have occurred to you or will occur to you after you've read the book in question. So thank you as always, and I look forward to joining you next week when we speak with James McBride regarding his new book, The Good Lord Bird.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.